I shall introduce Saskia while she settles down. I've heard of not arriving for your own funeral, but not arriving for the lecture, but thank goodness Saskia made it in time. I'm Stephen Hill. I'm editor of the British Journal of Sociology, and this is the first of the BJS Millennial Lecture Series being run by the British Journal of Sociology. We've just produced a special issue, which is full display outside, edited by John Urry, on sociology facing the next millennium. Contributors were asked to consider just what the millennium might include about the history of human studies and especially how sociology is facing up to the challenges and opportunities. Saskia is one of the contributors to that issue, and she's also at the moment in the LSE as a centennial professor based in the Department of Geography and Environment. The rest of her year she spends as Professor of Sociology at the University of Chicago. And Saskia is an internationally known and respected scholar. She has served on a large number of advisory panels, and she's received multiple awards. And the awards notably from the Ford Foundation, from the Tinker Foundation, from the Revson Foundation, and from the Chicago Institute for Architecture and Urbanism, and indeed the 20th Century Fund. As a person who's based both in the LSE and in Chicago, and as a person who's written on governance and accountability, the global city and the mobility of labor, and indeed on the world, cities and the world economy, Saskia is, I think, uniquely well qualified to talk to us today, and indeed uniquely qualified to write in the BJS special issue. The lecture today is going to be looking at the impacts of globalization and new digital technologies on nation states. And I believe, this is from my reading of what Saskia has written before, that she will be arguing that certain states, certain components of states have actually gained in power, contrary to the prevailing view that states inevitably lose power, and that, for example, ministers of finance and central banks are probably more powerful in the global era than before. I hope that's what Saskia is going to say. You can never tell, because she writes so fluently and so quickly that that may already be old hat. But I hope that's what you will be looking at. And you'll also be looking at the development of private digital space and the internet and its implications for sovereignty. So I'd like to welcome Saskia Sassen to give the first BJS lecture.
It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm going to talk, I guess, for about 45 minutes or an hour. After that, I will take questions, but only nice questions. I don't want to endure, I don't want to suffer. This is really new work for me. New, you know, in the academy, time has its own particularities. I've been working on this for 5 years. That still makes it new. I'm sort of getting to the end. It is a departure of my past work, because now I'm really trying to engage the question of the state. You said recognized, yes, but also very criticized scholar. And I have often been criticized for not dealing with the political. The only way, however, I could engage the political is through my very particular kind of analytics and kind of empirics, which means that when I speak about the state, I want to clarify this immediately. I'm really using that term as shorthand to describe a very particular kind of operation. This particular kind of operation is that moment when a non-state actor process dynamic, especially if it is global, encounters one or another instantiation of the state. I think it's very important to understand what I will say in the light of this kind of definition. Because I am not a political scientist, I don't think I ever will be one, and I'm not trying to be one. And certainly political scientists in the audience will have their disagreements and their criticisms with me. That is why the state, I would argue, is not only the preserve of political science, and I'm going at it in a way in a spatial fashion. It's a different way of engaging the question. Now, the title of this lecture is The State and the New Geography of Power. I have gotten quite a few questions from people. What exactly does that mean? I thought this was a transparent title. it evidently is not. One way of starting is to say that states, of course, have always, let's just think of modern times, confronted geographies of power of one kind or another. In the past, the main, if you want, threat to their authority was often another state. Think of the wars in Europe. Think of the wars for colonial subjugation. Another state is still the threat today for a lot of states, especially the weaker, the poorer, etc. My argument is that today, besides the question of dealing with other states, the main source of threats, if you want, to established state authority comes not from other states. It comes from a variety and indeed a growing range of non-state actors. These actors range from transnational corporations, global financial markets, NGOs, human rights activists, cyber hackers, cyber terrorists. It's a whole variety. And in some ways, there is growing institutionalizing of this geography of non-state actors. It really is a multiplicity of geographies of non-state actors. And my argument is that the development of this kind of alternative geographies of power that fall partly outside the frame of the state and the frame of the interstate system affect the scope, the competence, and the exclusivity of state authority, and thereby they also affect, if you want, the organizational infrastructure for the interstate system and hence international law. Now that was a mouthful. I by chance remembered my own paragraph, but I don't know, I hope that as the talk proceeds that this is clear. An implied hypothesis that someone could just pick up and do some serious research on is that the nature of the threat to state authority posed by these kinds of actors, in terms of the issues I mentioned, scope, exclusivity, etc., is different from the kind of threat to state authority posed by other states. And I say this is a hypothesis because I have not quite had the time to really, if you want, document, study, explore that hypothesis in its null version, if I may speak in that language. In the sense that I can, at this point, document, detect, and interpret the impact on state authority of these kinds of non-state actors. What I have not done, and it really is probably in the domain of another form of expertise, is to really document the ways in which other states may or may not, the threat that other states might represent to state authority may or may not coincide with what I'm trying to develop. Now, my argument diverges a bit from, I would say, what are very conventional views. A very conventional view in terms of this, if you want, threat to the authority of the state is that what we're really seeing is a decline in the regulatory capacities of national states. I think that what is happening is far more differentiated than a simple, if you want, not that it is simple, but that some sort of generalizable or generalized decline in the significance of the state, a much used phrase, and that it is secondly also far more transformative of the state than a mere loss of power suggests. Substantively, what I'm arguing is that the state today operates in a field of power that is far broader than was the case up till quite recently, when that field of power was to a very large extent the interstate system. Today, this field of power includes, as I said already, a variety of non-state actors, and it is a broader and increasingly institutionalized field of power. Secondly, the work of states. This is a transformative part of the state. The work of states has changed. Raison d'état, the substantive rationality of the state, has of course gone through many, many transformations over the centuries. My argument is that today we're seeing yet another such transformation, and that we cannot take it for granted. We really need to understand the specificity of the current transformation. What has happened with raison d'état? And just to make it concrete, what it is that I'm trying to say, if you just consider the ways in which many state leaders today assert, declare, that the state can no longer assume the kinds of costs that it had until recently assumed to promote the general well-being. And if you think of people on both on the right and on the left who are asking, why do we have states? What do we have them for? For different reasons. In the business, in certain sectors of the business community, less regulation, less government, etc. On the left, what do we have the state for if all that it seeks to support is the advantages of firms and markets to make them flourish? So this question of the raison d'état, if you want, the work of states, is to me an extremely important part of the discussion. And one of the issues that I'm trying to sort of develop in this issue of the work of states, again, is, I would argue, a second divergence with a lot of the literature on, for especially, globalization and the state. And that is the notion that the state is transformed in part because it actually participates in the process of globalization, not because it is a victim. And I come back to this issue of the transformative impact is not simply a mere loss of power. It is much more complex than that. In participating, the state, and again, I'm thinking of very particular instantiations here of the state. I'm not thinking about the state as an overarching, all-encompassing structure. But in participating, the state is transformed in particular ways, and I name these particular ways: incipient denationalization of what had been constructed historically as national. And I will return to this term. And yes, Stephen, you had it right. One of the changes is, in fact, and here again, I would say this is a third divergence that I have with some of the scholarship on the impact of globalization and the state, that certain parts of national states actually gain power because of globalization. And the darlings I'm thinking of are indeed the Ministry of Finance, central banks, departments of commerce, in the case of the United States, that very special entity. It has existed for a very long time. It has been very obscure for a very long time. Now it's very prominent, the U.S. Trade Representative, the International U.S. Trade Representative. And furthermore, and this for me represents a fourth, if you want, feature of the argument, because the state participates in the process of globalization, we as citizens, confined to national institutions, still, to a very large extent, for the execution, for the implementation, for the appropriation of the rights that we're granted by the state, find in the fact of this participation, I would argue, an institutional bridge to a new kind of politics, a politics of the global that takes place inside the national. So I think that one of the ways of developing a new politics in this era of globalization, partial as globalization might be, is not to think in terms of world state. I really do not know what that means. And here a footnote, when I came up with a global city, I came up with a global city because I couldn't think of what is the global economy. Those categories to me are so broad that they're not operational, if you want, for me as a researcher and as a theorist. So anyhow, same thing with this political issue. It's not a world state that I can think of. It is rather something that is more a politics of the global that gets enacted in a multiplicity of locals or nationals of some sort or another. If the state were merely a victim of globalization, if the state did not at all participate in the implementation of a global economic system, then I think we as citizens would not have that bridge, that particular bridge. We might have others, but that particular bridge we would not have. So in political terms and in theoretical terms, the task of documenting how the state actually participates in this process of globalization is extremely important because it signals a whole number of conditionalities and potentialities as I said, this new kind of politics, if you want, that one could think of. Now, in dealing with the state, I am certainly in this talk confining myself to a particular kind of state, the Western state. I'm dealing with a state under the rule of law. Vague and ambiguous as that term might be, I think it is forever an aspiration, yet we know operationally it does make a difference whether a state is under the rule of law. It's a problematic construct. I don't want to make it into a normative issue, but let me just use the category as it is usually deployed. This leaves out a lot of states. Further, I am speaking really about operational features of states rather than idealized notions or ideal types or categories of states. I really am interested in the work of states in the same way that when I was dealing with the global city, my concern was the work of running, of implementing, designing, fixing, etc., a political economic system. I'm using that same analytic strategy, if you want, in order to deal with questions about the state. Much of the institutional apparatus of the state has remained unchanged. I mean, in some cases, unchanged for centuries, frankly, except if you really want to go into the finer points. Certainly, the inertia of bureaucracies is a major contribution to continuity. It's also the case that when those bureaucracies break down, they can be spectacular. Vide the case of the Soviet Union, where you really have what I think of as not a case of dying, of living beyond your means, but of dying beyond your means. So on the one hand, bureaucratic inertia is a major contribution to continuity. On the other hand, changes do happen, and they're often very, very massive and if you want, catastrophic on some level. Let me follow up this first part with a more detailed description of what I see as the key features in this new geography of power within which these states operate, or if you want, a geography of power that confronts these states. Three elements I want to emphasize tonight. There really are many more that one could emphasize, but to me these three are crucial, and it's a bit sort of my formulation. So the way I mix the elements up is not necessarily, you know, part of a standardized analysis. First, what we have is an increasingly institutionalized governance system, really, which is private. And it's a governance system of the global economic system. I say increasingly institutionalized because, again, there is a lot of discussion, a lot of talk that suggests that what firms really want, what multinationals want, what global financial markets want, is no government. The truth of the matter is that none of those big firms and none of those markets want a Wild West. They all want governance, but they want it their way. They really do want their cake, and they want to eat it too. So it's a certain kind of governance that they want. Over the last 7 or 8 years, we have seen an enormous amount of work done by legal experts, by managerial experts, by accountants. Accountants have been enormously creative in the last 5 or 7 years. They have really become designers of whole new modes of operating for firms and for markets. And they have constructed new regimes with standards and with all kinds of institutional infrastructures if you want to execute this privatized governance. I think it is extremely important to emphasize the extent to which this is being institutionalized. Secondly, in this first presence, if you want, in this landscape of power, what also has happened is that it's not just about technocratic competence. You know, how do you run these systems? What has also happened is that a certain kind of normative power has attached to these regimes, to these standards, to some of these bodies. And one way in which I try to capture this is by saying that what we're seeing is a privatizing in norm-making capacities that used to be located in the state. In other words, there is an issue of normativity that is caught up in these new mechanisms for governance. It is not just raw power. We see the same capacity for norm-making in the second set of actors that I see in this landscape, which are also increasingly institutionalized. It's the world of human rights activists. It's the world of NGOs. It's a whole variety of different types of non-state actors who are really exercising growing influence in that world. And also here, it's not just a question of somehow having power. It is really a question of having authority. And authority gets you to norm-making capacities. Authority is different from power. So what we're really talking about are privatized systems of authority. Now, these privatized systems of authority, to which I add, just to make it a bit more complicated, that they have norm-making capacities, we can indeed also add conditions that reflect raw power. The global capital market has raw power. A lot of the NGOs in some of the countries where they're operating have what you could really think of as raw power. So raw power is not just something that goes with what could one might just sort of quickly say, these are the bad guys. No, some of the good guys also have raw power in certain situations. But for me, that is almost less interesting than the fact that what we're seeing are these new privatized authorities and the fact that they have norm-making capacities. These are big words that I just produced on these subjects, these norm-making capacities. These are capacities that are incipient, that are in development, in formation. They're not finalized, they're not complete. They may suffer withdrawals, they may suffer defeats, they may suffer replacement. But the point is that in my reading of that landscape, in my reading of that new geography of power, this is one of the features. And again, in terms of the broader question of what represents a threat or an imposition or what could have an effect on state authority, I would ask the question, how is this kind of private norm-making capacity different from the normativity associated with the state? In other words, in this geography of power where you have multiple states, each one of those states has embedded normativity, that is raison d'etat. Is that normativity vis-a-vis a single state a different element, a different kind of threat, is it a different kind of constraint than what is the normativity attached to this private institutionalized regime that concerns the global economy and to these other non-state actors, the human rights activists, et cetera, the NGOs. I don't think there are simple answers to this. I don't have a definitive answer. My thesis is that there is a difference. When we're dealing just with states who can impinge, we know this from war, can impinge very severely on other states. I do think that within that, you still have an overall dynamic that contributes to the strengthening of the interstate system. And we have seen this in Europe. There are few continents that have had as many major wars and sustained wars as Europe. And there are few continents where you have had such a development of the interstate system and such a formalizing of agreements and of treaties, etc. I think that in this new geography of power, these issues are different. This accumulation that war among states could produce in terms of developing this interstate system, you just don't see that. And I do think in that sense, it really represents an impact on the questions of scope of state authority, the normative power of the state, the competence of the state, and the exclusivity of state authority. Just to illustrate a bit more, in this first element in this landscape, these first landscape of power, these privatized institutional actors, the things that I'm talking about are, for instance, the fact that most businesses today which engage in cross-border contracts or agreements use privatized systems of justice to settle their disputes. Now, not all businesses that engage in cross-border contracts have disputes, but all contracts will have clauses that specify how the disputes, if they arise, will be settled. They are now almost all settled privately. What does that mean? That means that the whole purpose of the dispute settlement process is to avoid going through national courts. This, we call this international commercial arbitration. It has grown enormously. International commercial arbitration centers have been set up in all the countries that join, if you want, the global economic system. And the purpose, the whole purpose of this institutional world is to avoid national court systems. This is, in other words, a privatized system of justice. And it's working fine. And the participants and the beneficiaries are very happy with it. Or at least, you know, that is what we hear. Secondly, in many sectors where you have dominance of a few large firms, we now have self-imposed regulatory regimes. You can only do this when a sector is dominated by a few large firms. If you have a sector which has an enormous number of a lot of little firms, it becomes much more difficult. So you have, on the one hand, the lifting of regulations that are state regulations, because that's what has happened in many of these sectors, and on the other, the development within these sectors through the private firms that constitute it, a development of regulations. Standards, the same question. And I could go on and on. I want to mention a final example because it really is of a different sort, financial services firms. In my reading, financial services firms have emerged, I'm talking about the top ones, as key agents in the implementation of this alternative world of regulation. When a financial services firm goes into an Eastern European country that does not have a highly developed financial or banking system, they introduce little micro transformations, micro developments in the, for instance, depository systems, as they're called, of these economies. So these financial services firms, which are really private actors, that doesn't make them criminal, by the way. You know, they embed the law, supposedly. But they are instituting transformations in the legal frameworks of many, many economies. These are different modes than modes from the past. In the past, these things were done differently. Now, the past here, the past is a problematic category. I'm talking different periods of time for different kinds of countries or parts of the world. I want to just say a couple of things about the second institutional actor, human rights, NGOs, etc. I think that human rights, of course, have existed for a long time, but it is really only in the last 10 or 15 years that the impact has occurred in a way that it has occurred, and that some additional agreements were signed, which made possible, for instance, the Pinochet case. And in fact, a number of leaders that are considered dictators are now have been served lawsuits, or whatever they are called in that particular sort of, whatever the technical language. So these are, in a way, new developments. They exist within a broader, older historical framework, but they really are new developments. And again, the irony here, of course, is that they're happening on some level outside the state, but have to go through the state, i.e. through one or another institution of the state, often, not always, but often, in order to get implemented. Caught up in this whole world of issues, I also see new versions of citizenship. And this is a subject that I'm working on. I cannot really dwell on this, but the notion is that it's not quite post-national citizenship, but it is more, in my way of thinking about it, an incipient denationalizing of certain components of citizenship. The human rights regime is a strategic agent in producing this new form of citizenship. Strictly legally speaking, one might not be able to make that argument, but in some sort of broader sense, the whole question of what is a citizen is a very controversial subject right now. So just to make a long story short, I see a whole number of presences also in this broader geography of power that relocate, on the one hand, functions that used to be inside national states outside the state, and in the other, generate strength, empowerment, new kinds of capabilities think of the human rights regime, for instance, in actors and organizations and regimes that are outside the national state. There's a third kind of element in this landscape of power that I see. And this has to do with the question of digital space, and I do want to speak a bit about that. And here, for me, a crucial distinction that is not sufficiently often made, in my view, is the distinction between private digital space and public digital space. Now, public digital space does not mean that the public owns it, because increasingly the backbone for all digital, you know, think of the internet, is private. But it does mean that it is a space that one has access to. You may have to pay a fee, you need a computer, et cetera, but you have access to it. There is another world of digital space, and many people are not aware of this, which is truly private. There is no access. There is no internet service provider that is going to get you to that. This is the world of global finance, the world of, you know, dedicated lines, et cetera, et cetera. Up to a certain point, I disagree with some of the interpretations that suggest that the internet is a major threat to the authority of the state. I disagree because when I look at private digital space, I see a far larger threat to the authority of the state than that which comes from public digital space. At the same time, and I will talk a bit about this, today, public digital space, the internet, has become an increasingly active zone for all kinds of new tactics. And again, I think that we've all heard the language, activists, hacktivists, coming from hackers, and cyber terrorists. So we are really dealing, I think, with a new phase, and I will read some illustration, some statements that describe some of this. But first I want to stick just for a minute with this question of private digital space. I was recently in a debate about the impact of digitalization on the sovereignty of the state, and I found myself confronting a whole line of mostly legal scholars, incredibly intelligent and bright, but they all just assumed that digital space was the internet. And this really struck me. Now, I come at questions of digital space precisely from the world of global finance, so I have from the beginning been extremely sensitive to this fact of private digital space. The features of digital networks that we have all talked about are operative in private digital space as well. And they have the effect of raising the power and the capacities of private global financial actors, firms, enormously. In the same way that in the internet, these same features of digital networks have the capacity to produce what we have all heard before, distributed power, that's good power, because everybody has access, decentralization, simultaneity, connectivity, etc. These same features translated to the world of private digital networks produce good, old-fashioned, concentrated power. They have raised the capacities contained in global financial markets enormously. Part of the growth in the value of the global financial market has to do with the fact that these are largely digitalized markets. And just to give you just a figure, just for comparative purposes, the figures that I'm talking about, and hence the this is raw power, by the way, that I'm talking about. We all know that global GDP is big, right? Global 30 trillion. Global consumption in the world, big too, 24 trillion. Foreign direct investment stock, big, 6 trillion. This was sort of last year. Global trade, grown enormously, big, another 6 trillion more or less. Well, the global capital market, I just take value of traded derivatives in 1999, we have the figures for 99, this is instantaneous information you get on those markets, 64 trillion. We're talking global trade, 6 trillion, foreign direct investment stock, 6 trillion, 64 trillion. We're changing orders of magnitude. This is not just more zeros. It looks that way, but it really is changing order of magnitude. We don't know exactly what that means. We don't know what kind of money that is. Saying 64 trillion is giving you a monetized measure. but it really does not reflect, it does not tell the story of what it is. But it does indicate the enormous concentrated power that is located in the global financial markets. When you consider that national states, all the countries in the world together, have a GDP of 30 trillion. If you look at, you can multiply the variables that you want to mention. The point here is that when you look at private digital space, you're dealing with forms of power that really have had the capacity to undermine state authority. And it's sort of a complicated argument that I want to make very, very short. This is not the time to really dwell on it, and there is no time. But the point here is that because of this power, because of this raw power, global finance, the logic, the operational logic of global finance has had the capacity to impose its, if you want, operational logic on economic policy making in certainly the rich countries, the highly developed countries. And a lot of what we call neoliberal economic policy, in my reading, and not everybody agrees with me on this, in my reading is really a version of the operational logic of the global capital market. And I could sort of run you through it, but I don't think that this is the time to do that. So when I think of the impact of the digital world on state authority, my first stop is with global finance, and that means private digital networks. Now, there is a part of finance that you've all heard about in the newspapers, online trading, you know, et cetera. That is not the world that I'm talking about. That happens in public space, you know, but I'm talking really about global financial markets that are the leading capital markets, and they are not, they are owned basically by firms. So it's a certain kind of global capital market that I'm talking about. Now, in terms of the internet, most of what happens on it, you've all seen it, those of you who have had times, is really junk. You know, I mean, it's just overloaded with. However, it has emerged as a very significant tool, space, for a certain kind of politics and for a certain kind of private power. On the one hand, activism, good old-fashioned activism, is enhanced, promoted, facilitated, better organized, and a key feature for me that marks the specificity of internet politics is simultaneous localities getting engaged in a global project. Again, it's my image here is not a global space, but a multiplicity of local sites or servers or whatever that form the internet, engaged, however, in a global project. I think the organizing around WTO in Seattle captured that. I think that we had a lot of activity on the net. The opposition to the MAI, the Multilateral Agreement on Investment, for those of you who may know about this, same story. So it's interesting. And we have incredibly good evidence right now on the variety of ways in which this can get activated. The wars in the in Yugoslavia and Kosovo, etc., all of these benefited or did not, whatever. But the question of digital activism was a crucial part of it. And it is truly a global network. And I would love to go on and talk really at length about this, but I can't. Now, let me move, on the other hand, to something which is less known about, and that, though much reported in the press, and that is activity by hackers. In other words, invading computer systems, blocking sites, sending email bombs, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't know how many of you are aware of the stuff. I'm sure that anybody who reads the newspaper knows that there are hackers and that every now and then computer systems get broken into. What you don't know, because the parties who are being attacked typically are not very interested in making it too known, is how much of this is happening and how deep it can move. And the one thing when we think about other forms of attacking state authority, the one thing about hacktivism, which is absolutely striking, is that it can go right zero in to the heart of whatever the target it is seeking to reach. It doesn't have to deal with the country, doesn't have to deploy ground troops, etc. It can go straight to the server or the computers, etc., that are managing, you know, the utilities, whatever it might be. And in fact, in the United States, which is, if I were a hacker, hey, that would be my favorite target to play with, probably, you know, because in the United States, in 1996, President Clinton actually set up a very elaborate commission and policy and sort of a whole special agency that had to deal, and it has not been publicized particularly much because really the government is not particularly interested in making it known that they are continuously being hacked. And what is absolutely, when you read sort of the script, you know, for this new commission, you see that it is in charge of protecting infrastructure for water, emergency systems, you know, hospitals, ambulances, etc., traffic control. So all of these listed, and then item number 8, banking and finance. You know, all of the other items are all about sort of basic infrastructure for survival and meeting the needs of people and populations, etc. And then, but also banking and finance. It is clear that in an economic system where finance is such a significant part of the story, and where it is so embedded in digital kinds of infrastructures, it's very vulnerable. It's far more vulnerable than activism. I mean, there's regularly activism against banks. Just in December, a Russian, we know now it's Russian, a Russian transnational criminal organization got into 15,000 accounts for Visa. That's nothing given that they have millions, but they absolutely wiped out those accounts. So this is continuously happening in finance as well. But still, we don't hear very much about it. Now, one of the things, again, about hacktivism that is very interesting is that it has given a chance to certain kinds of actors. The Zapatistas, you know, and we now talk about digital Zapatismo, right, are a very good example. To highly, if you want, decentered actors, poor, powerless, who in the past might have been totally dependent on mainstream media, which might or might not know even that they existed, to get their message across, can, in this new digital landscape, really get their message across. And I want to read you, this is from a paper from Dorothy Denning, who has collected a lot of information in this. And she just, I'm just going to read this. In what some U.S. intelligence authorities characterized as the first known attack by terrorists against a country's computer systems, ethnic Tamil guerrillas were said to have swarmed Sri Lankan embassies with thousands of electronic mail messages. The messages read, "We are the internet black tigers and we're doing this to disrupt your communications." Now, this group that did this was an offshoot of the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam, which had been fighting for an independent homeland, etc. We all know that. Now, this is a very tiny organization in some ways. This is an offshoot of an organization that is part of a larger organization. It's not all the Tamils. And they managed to produce an action that was profoundly disruptive. And again, we're not talking about people who are at the heart of, you know, the world system. We're talking about people who are at the edges, the same thing with the Zapatistas. And there is example after example of this. So hacktivism does suggest a modality of participating in a power exchange that makes it possible for, if you want, the little guys, I mean, these are little guys on some scale, to engage the U.S., you know, all the Western embassies, whatever it might be. And there is a final feature about hacktivism, which I think is very interesting. And you can see, I mean, it is a form of warfare. And according to some people, I love this, actually, that the more hacktivism we have, actually, the better, because it does relocate part of war activity or terrorism that would be happening involving people, death, blood, etc., to something, you know, that is, after all, digital. I mean, what you're destroying are computer systems. You know, it is different from destroying bodies, human bodies. So, but then there is another, there's a sort of a, I can't quite call it an etiquette, because, you know, in war, etiquette is, but there was, for instance, an underground group of hacktivists who wanted to, who are busy attacking China, basically. And they are dissidents, you know, very interesting people. And one of them launched this pronouncement, you know, on this declaration of war, if you want, to the country of China, coming from this organization. And it said, "We want to destroy all the infrastructure involving communication capacities of China. Immediately, a worldwide network of hacktivists came online and said, this is not hacktivism. But this is very important. Hacktivism is not about attacking a country and certainly not about destroying its communication infrastructure. And so immediately then that group had to withdraw its threat and had to reframe its attack in terms of what it was that it was going to try to attack, which was to attack certain control capacities of the Chinese government over internet access, certain distribution of information, et cetera, et cetera. And you see a whole proliferation of these, if you want, codes of how you do it, what is this and what is that. The other thing that is very striking, when you think war again, you know, this is a form of war. I mean, let's not fool ourselves. The language of war in our Western history, certainly, if you think the language that is used, for instance, by the United States, just to mention one little country here in the West, to name its latest airplane, stealth, you know, that's the language. Well, there is, when you look at the names that hacktivist groups have, very different. For instance, there's one group that is very active of dissidents, very effective, very well organized, again, against the Chinese government, and they call themselves Hong Kong Bells, you know, bells as in bell. It's a world that has, of course, strong elements of play in it, but it is a serious world, but it really relocates the language, it relocates the targets, et cetera, et cetera. And we are really seeing quite a bit of it. There are many, again, the technicalities of it in themselves are very interesting, the whole notion of email bombs, how you do that, virtual blockades, a lot of this stuff is happening. The United States government has suffered each one of these options, if you want. It has experienced shutdowns of servers, shutdowns of offices, et cetera, et cetera. Now, final comment on this particular aspect, cyber terrorism. According to the experts, we have not yet had cyber terrorism. Because what cyber terrorism would mean is hitting via digital tools, civil populations. Not necessarily killing them, but hitting them. And there are sort of examples that are mentioned in these analyses, which, just to illustrate what we're talking about. Now, that could happen. For instance, to tamper with traffic control systems in airports. That could, of course, kill. But this has not happened. And I will explain in a minute why some of these things have not happened. Another example that has been given is that you raise, for instance, the iron content in cereal eaten by children, thereby poisoning, you know, certainly in the United States where every kid seems to eat cereal. I have never eaten cereal when I was a child, but hey, in the US, you know, raise the iron potential, the iron content of it, and you can devastate slowly or quickly a young population. Things like that, you know, hitting the infrastructure for hospitals, things like that. Now, why has this not happened? The answer is actually a very interesting one, and it's an answer that in the future might no longer be operative. One of the main reasons, according to the experts, this is not my interpretation, these are experts speaking on this particular subject, one of the reasons it hasn't happened, that in all of those systems, there is a very strong human factor involved. Humans are in the loop. It is not 100% computerized systems. Hence, for instance, just to make it concrete, I love these reports, the iron in the cereal. Okay, what happens? Assembly line. The workers are, all this iron, it weighs a ton what comes out of that if you add more. Moreover, the supply of iron is reduced that you are adding, you know, as the cereal box moves along the assembly line, declines much faster than it ought to. Suddenly there's no more iron where there's still, et cetera. Here are humans involved and they can pick up on it. Traffic control. All pilots know that they have to be aware of possible failures, et cetera, et cetera. But the key issue that I find very interesting in all of this is that so long as you have humans, at least thus far, the way things have gone, so long as you have humans in the loop somewhere, even in highly digitalized systems, there is a check and balance possibility that has, again, been seen or interpreted as being one of the critical factors that has meant that we have not really had cyber terrorism as such. Now, I want to conclude and to say that one of the issues that for me comes out of this research, which is very important, is, as I said already, the fact that you have raw power out there, growing institutionalizing of it, and also a new kind of normativity or norm-making capacities that attach to these private actors. But there is a second issue that I haven't really quite developed. I have dwelt on it, I've brought it into the picture, but I haven't developed it. And that is this notion that the state, through one or another instantiation, participates in a lot of these processes that I'm talking about. Very simple and evident cases, human rights regime, it depends on national courts supporting that, on national states through legislatures, etc., implementing them. The same thing with the powerful global economic actors. They need central banks to institute certain types of monetary policies. They need ministries of finance to institute certain kinds of fiscal policies. When I say they need, what I'm talking about is if you're going to have a global capital market, you need certain kinds of monetary policy, certain types of fiscal policy, etc. There is a very broad scholarship on all of this. What we have also in all the highly developed countries, increasingly in the less developed countries, is a proliferation within the government of technical agencies that are in charge of regulating various economic processes. And these technical agencies are producing work, if you want, are engaged in tasks that used to be in the legislatures very often, and now have been relocated to these very, very privatized worlds of technical agencies. Now, in my view, and it's just one kind of interpretation, this kind of participation by the state. Secondly, the fact that the state, if you want, through, for instance, the policies implemented in with the central banks, that the state becomes the institutional home for some of these policies that are crucial for having, if you want, a global economic system, a global capital market. All of these kinds of participations, which are all partial, they're all incomplete, if you want, incipient, they're not, you know, necessarily going to be the way they are now forever, but they are happening, they are developments. All of these various forms of participation, as I said earlier, for me represent a very significant transformation in terms of some critical aspects in the nature of the state in our contemporary era. And one way of naming the difference, one way of naming that change, is to call this an incipient denationalizing of what historically had been constructed as national. Now, that historically constructed is to me very important in both its parts. Historically, because it could have been the last 100 years. In some countries, the last 200 years, in others. In Europe, a much longer process than in other parts of the world. And by saying denationalization, I'm really trying to do a couple of things. One is to distinguish, to make a distinction with globalization. Globalization being, on some level, an achieved condition. And I want to move back, and I want to recover how we get to that thing that we call the global economy or the global system, etc. And so looking at the extent to which that which we call globalization is partly endogenous to national states, in that it's not simply done to it, it's not simply coming from the outside, in that, and this way of capturing, if you want, the ways in which the state participates in the implementation of a global economic system is one way of describing this, understanding that. So, coming back to the first point that I made when I started speaking, that the state today confronts this new geography of power, and that this entails really a highly differentiated process and a transformative process of the state itself. And to wrap it up, differentiated because it is certain parts of national states that get involved in these processes that deal with this broader geography of power that is part of globalization. Not all. And those are the ones, as I said already, that gain power. Transformative, because the state, in participating, insofar as some parts of the state gain power, is transformed. And I think the way in which it is transformed is through this incipient denationalizing of what had been constructed as national. Now, that is different. That is a different kind of analysis from the analysis that simply argues that the state loses power. The state has lost powers, has lost capacities, has lost things that it used to have, resources, et cetera, et cetera. That's all fine. This is not the point that I'm trying to make. The point that I'm trying to make is that you take an institution like the Central Bank, Ministry of Finance, these are national institutions. But they're not national in the way they were national up to 20 years ago, or in the way they have been national for the last 100 years. And in that sense, this term of denationalization as one name for this transformative process. What this means in the long run for the authority of the state is to be seen. But I do think that it signals a change in the fact that there are out there conditions that affect the authority of the state, a change compared to the former condition, which is that interstate system, those other states, are what mostly affect the power of the state. And to wrap it up, again, I do think that, as I indicated, that one of the reasons it matters is for theory. It's a way of theorizing what has happened to the state, which is really quite different from simply saying the state is a victim, the state loses power, etc. But the other reason for emphasizing this is the fact that I think that it does signal the possibility of a politics of the global, a politics that can demand accountability from global actors, that goes through the national. In my way of looking at it then, maybe that's sort of what I like to think as the sober Dutch side of me, the fact that it goes through the national, partly, not completely, but partly, persuades me of its greater viability. The fact that the state, parts of the state, become an ambiguous frontier zone between the global and the national. That which we have perhaps constructed as a line dividing the national from the global, because we have constructed the line in terms of dividing one national from another national, is actually an ambiguous terrain where lots of engagements can take place. And some of these engagements can involve what we, for shorthand, could call emancipatory politics, rather than just the politics of power. For that to happen, it will take a lot of work. Our politicians will have to do their homework, and we citizens will have to do our homework. These institutional bridges that our own state offers us for this new kind of politics are not lying ready-made on shelves. They really have to be invented, they have to be designed, they have to be made. But I do think that one thing that one can take out of this reading of what's happening with the state in the contemporary moment is that there is a possibility for a new kind of politics, a politics that is partly outside of the framework of the state, all these privatized actors that I talked about, but also a politics that is partly inside and going through the state. And for us citizens, I think this should really be a rather important option to pursue. I thank you very much for your attention. Now, I can take a few questions. Is that? Yes. Oh my God, yes, I remember, yes.
Thank you. There's one, I was surprised you left out two sets of institutions. It seemed to me to play a very important role in the issues that you're raising. One are the International Monetary Fund, ILO,
yes.
World Trade Organization,
right.
And the degree to which national governments are pooling sovereignty or are seeking international solutions through such institutions
yes.
to deal with the problems of globalization. And secondly, the other institutions are those at regional level, in particular the European Union, which I suppose is the most advanced of these kinds
mm-hmm.
of institutions,
mm-hmm.
where at the mediating role that the European Union is playing, particularly in the case of the British nation state, is evident every day of the week. And this is having quite a significant impact
yes.
on Britain as a nation state, indeed all the other countries of Europe,
yeah.
as a new kind of politic of your powers being developed at European level, not least in response to globalization.
No, absolutely crucial points that you mentioned. And I, of course, should have mentioned them. There are probably a few other things will come up. But I do think that this issue of the supranational organizations is one that is interesting. And I see them evolving alongside the ascendance of subnational institutions. And certainly the European Union represents a reconfiguring with a shift of competences to the supranational level and a shift of competences to subnational. All of these issues do amount to a reconfiguring of that bounded unit that we have historically, certainly for the last 150 years, thought of as a national state. The role that the supranational institutions play in this broader landscape that I've talked about is, number one, varied. Like things, institutions related to human rights issues that's going to be different from the IMF. Secondly, changeable. And here again, to me, if you take the IMF executes its program in Latin America, in Mexico, fine. Goes to South Asia, fails miserably, highly criticized, et cetera, et cetera. They're learning. Whether they learn fast or slow is another matter. But what I want to pull out of that is the fact that it is it's a changing operation. The meaning of the supranationals, the scope of their competence, the authority that they have is not a fixed condition right now. For a while there in the 90s, we saw an enormous gain of power by supranationals. Today, it's not that they are losing power, but I think that the rate of increase of that power and that stabilized a bit, I would say. In terms of Europe, I think Europe is, of course, enormously interesting, enormously complex. I'm sure that there are many experts here on the European Union. And one of the issues that I have been particularly concerned with in the case of Europe, the particular, if you want, concrete realm through which I have engaged the European Union question is the question of immigration and immigration policy. And here, one of the things I have found stunning is the growing distance between the rhetorics of unilateralism that still mark a lot of speaking by sovereigns, by national governments, and the actual objective shift of competences from the national to that supranational level that has happened. And I think that we might be seeing parallel distances in other domains as well. So that definitely the supranational institutions are a growing and a more significant part of this landscape, even though we may have in the 90s, granted them more power and influence and a future rate of growth in influence that perhaps is not quite happening. In many cases, I think with the IMF and the World Bank, it's a change. This gets to be a technical discussion, I think. I am not one of those who think that what's happening in the last couple of years with the IMF and the World Bank represents the same sort of rate of increase in their influence. I think there is a repositioning of these. Now, who are the other actors that are part of the repositioning are not necessarily national governments, but this world of private institutional actors, which is having more and more influence in some ways on the IMF and the World Bank. So what I see is a triangulation, and in that sense, a very particular kind of positioning on the part of the IMF and the World Bank, for one. There's much more to be said on this, but yes.
Glenn Siegel, Institute of Security Policy. I'm extremely grateful for you for elaborating on two terms which I've always had problems dealing with, one which is power and another one which is authority. However, I was rather upset that there were two further terms which were not mentioned, one of which was legitimacy.
Ah, yes.
And the other one of which was identity.
Mm-hmm.
So could you please comment on the perspective of the individual and the collective individual on the issues of power and authority vis-a-vis or through the mirror of legitimacy?
Right. Well, I mean, I actually use the term legitimacy in my work a lot, and the power to legitimate and what are legitimate claims. It's actually, I have a book which deals a lot with these issues, believe it or not. I realized today I didn't mention it. But I did mention something that is a stand-in for this, when I made the distinction between power and authority. And I said that authority is not just a question of power. Authority has a certain normative aspect to it, i.e. a certain kind of legitimacy. It's not just simply either legitimate power. When I talked about citizenship, coming back to the question of legitimacy and identity, and I said that there are changes in this institution, they're difficult to trace, difficult to name, because it's a very sort of dynamic situation. But what I was, in a way, also alluding to is earlier work that I have done, and I'm still actually doing it, which is this notion that in the last 10 years, one of the things that we have seen is that the position of the sovereign, I'm using the language of international law because that's really what I want to talk about here, the position of the sovereign as the undisputed representative of its people, if democratically elected, blah, 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 in international fora, is being undermined by a whole set of moves by subnational collectivities, whether it's First Nation people in some of these countries, certain minorities that feel discriminated against, certain aspects of feminism, certain aspects of the gay political community, who resist being subsumed in the aggregate collective identity that the sovereign supposedly represents. And there is a very interesting literature on this. And in one sense, one of the things that I have sort of, one of the ways in which I formalize it is that we all recognize that popular sovereignty was a massive advance in the question of state power, right? Because it meant that it had to be democratically elected. It was no longer the right of kings, whatever, democratically elected sovereign. Well, what has been much less noted is that the new constitutions, Argentina, Brazil, South Africa, the Central European constitutions, all contain clauses now which make the following declaration in one way or another. In the Brazilian constitution, enormously elaborate. I mean, they just spell it all out. It's too much. In the Central European constitutions, less spelled out. But this is the declaration that a sovereign, even if democratically elected, cannot presume to represent all its people in international fora. This is a new kind of politics. Now, it's one clause in constitutions that to some extent read like any of the good old constitutions that we have had, you know, the Western style, US, French, etc. style. So here, for me, is a new formalized space for a politics that picks up on the fact that there might be subjects or types of identity, if you want, that are resisting this aggregate membership in the sovereigns, you know, people, whatever. So now, to me, these are all the issues you raise are extremely important, and they mark a conceptual landscape: power, authority, legitimacy, identity. What's the other one? I think we have it: power, authority, legitimacy. Those four, exactly. And I hope that what I just said now, just in mentioning these constitutions, is a way of illustrating how I'm going about it. The question of citizenship that I alluded to in my talk, what I was trying to get at when I said that we're seeing an incipient denationalizing of certain components of citizenship, what I'm trying to get at is that we have assumed historically, just take the last 150 years when I say historically, think the West, frankly, you know, I do think things play out in differently in different parts of the world, but we have assumed that the location of citizenship as an institution is in the national state. Formally speaking, administratively speaking, and legally speaking, this is indeed the case. There's no doubt about it. However, I would argue that today, with this unbundling that we're seeing of the national, coming back to the supranational and subnational aspects that we talked about before, referring back to some of the issues that I talked about, that the scope, the competence, the exclusivity of state authority and the normative power of state authority are all being altered, that the entity is partly unbundled, all of that signals that we have to recognize that what lies, I think, which in its beginning right now, but it's happening now, is a locating of certain components of that institution that we call citizenship in non-national settings. The human rights regime is the most evident case. The irony there is always the fact that it has got to go through national institutions in order to be implemented, to a very large extent, but I think less so, that's also changing. But there are other ways in which immigrants in Europe, for instance, are organizing at the European level and are claiming a political identity that cannot be subsumed under being a citizen or a resident alien or whatever. So when you map it, again, this is my analytic strategy always, to look at the operational features rather than just the rhetorical aspect of it or the formalized language about it, I do see a number of operational aspects that signal changes in this institution of citizenship, very specifically the fact that some of its components are being relocated to something that is non-national. I have done this kind of work for sovereignty. I've argued, and also in the context of the European Union, it's not that sovereignty, that particular mix of power and legitimacy that we're talking about when we say sovereignty, is disappearing or changing or, no. It's that certain components of sovereignty that were embedded in the national state are being relocated to other kinds of instantiations. The European Union is a good example. Some of this privatized norm-making capacity that I was talking about is another example of this. You know, there is something happening, and I have studied it at greater length with sovereignty than with the institution of citizenship. But the category identity is crucial. And then another issue on the legitimacy question, one of the ways in which I map what's happening is by asking the question, who has the legitimacy to make claims? Or whose claims are rendered legitimate? When I talked about the authority of the global capital market and its logic, I'm also talking about something that you can describe as the legitimacy of the claim made by that kind of institutional world on national states. What is the answer to that claim? The instituting of certain kinds of monetary policies in central banks, or certain kinds of fiscal policies through ministries of finance, et cetera, et cetera. So the landscape, as I see it, the geography of power, is really made up of a whole variety of components. Yes, raw power, but also all of these other things that move to authority, normativity, legitimacy. All right, it was almost a second lecture. I think one more question and then we're done.
Only one more because we do need to finish fairly soon.
Well, look, that's a big question. That's an enormous research project. I think it is an extremely important issue. That is why I keep mentioning that I'm not addressing that. I think that we're seeing a multiplicity of trajectories opening up. Somebody mentioned pooling of sovereignties. There are certain issues that are novel, Well, the truth is, I cannot answer this question intelligently. So let me just write a book on it, and in 10 years you can have it. Thank you very much.